you. I've always collected images. The problem is that for most of my life, I never knew what to do with them. In the past, I would explain this compulsion away to myself as a search for pattern, meaning, and a semblance of order in what has often been a ragged and disorderly existence, a defence mechanism for staving off chaos and dismay. I now realise that this was not quite the whole truth. Like most children of the age of mass communication, I became an obsessive consumer of images from the moment I learned to focus. A preschool love of comics provided a gateway drug to the harder thrills of Marvel and DC comics at about the age of 10, and then slightly later, the illicit and intoxicating and utopian visions of the then thriving underground press, followed closely by the dystopian grit of punk magazines and alternative press. These multifarious publications, baked for, stolen, borrowed, or bought with every last available penny of pocket money, unemployment check, or student grant, were, however, merely grist for what was to become an all-consuming obsession. I would pore over every available item of newsprint, searching for and tearing or cutting out any images that interested, inspired, or startled me. I would do the same to my parents' and grandparents' newspapers and colour supplements, to my mother's copies of She or Woman's Realm, my sister's Jackie's or Disco 45's, and to certain magazines my father naively assumed were discreetly hidden. This unbridled butchery even extended, I'm afraid to say, and very ashamed to say, certain books. The purpose of all this vandalism was to provide me with the raw material for what my adolescent imagination initially conceived as a vast treasure store or infinite archive of images, which would be stored in hundreds, even thousands, of scrapbooks, or else assembled as a gigantic, impossibly complex collages, all of which would eventually evolve into a visual map of everything. These rather early megalomaniac tendencies were obviously a source of deep distress and concern for my parents, and I was at various times threatened with psychiatrists, unspecified and ungodly sounding outdoor activities, Sunday school, and worst of all, membership of the Boy Scouts or Boys Brigade. By the time I left home, I'd accumulated dozens of boxes, suitcases and bags of all descriptions, crammed with tens of thousands of scraps and images, many torn and cut for what are now probably incredibly valuable artefacts. Encouraged by a couple of disapproving and deeply unimpressed girlfriends and recurrent bouts of ennui, I eventually abandoned my doomed attempt at constructing a physical version of the kind of universal labyrinthine library that had previously only existed in the imaginations of a Borges, of a M.C. Escher, or a Piranesi, a library constructed out of old copies of Oz, Howard the Duck, Ripped and Torn, or Titbits. Still, I had at least managed to fill a few scrapbooks and even succeeded in cobbling together a collage or two along the way. Sadly, or perhaps thankfully, between my first free festival and my first eviction, I'd either discarded, lost, or abandoned this mouldering stockpile of scraps. Over the course of the subsequent chaotic decades, my obsession with patterns may have been sublimated, but it never left me. It simply manifested itself in different ways. I managed to blag a reasonably successful living as a professional musician, a uni-digit keyboard prodder with very little technical ability and no previous experience. But In working in the music business, I realised I had a sort of natural flair for arrangement and production, which after all are forms of pattern making. After a few years of critical and industry acclaim, but widespread public indifference, the band I was a member of imploded and self-destructive in the messiest and, again, quite clichéd manner. Unwilling to spend my days trapped in danking East London basements, programming hi-hats and quantizing bass guitars, I found a job in a bookshop where, to the consternation and bemusement of long-suffering co-workers, I became obsessed with merchandising, display, the arrangement and disposition of books on shelves, and so on. Once again, a pattern-making impulse made manifest, and strangely rewarding for a year or two at least. Then, at a moment of crisis, I lost sight of the patterns and of the pathway and the pathways through the patterns, and I succumbed to disarray and disillusion in a kind of cliched boring lexicon of midlife crisis cliches. When the inevitable crash and burn occurred, I was homeless, alone. I was quite seriously ill. And according to eyewitnesses, some reliable eyewitnesses, I was blue. Bedbound and in unfamiliar homes for several months, and against my better judgment, I eventually succumbed to the constant encouragement of and exhortations from friends and a few kind and well-meaning my sisters, and I signed up to Facebook, despite the fact that I didn't actually own a computer or a functioning, functioning mobile phone at the time. The emerging world of social media, revealed through the prism of my ancient mobile phone, seemed to me incredibly bland and unutterably mundane. Gradually, however, I began to create a network of connections. And as I did so, the realization dawned on me that social media is as much a visual as a verbal medium. From that point on, I decided to forget all about attempting witty badinage with total strangers and concentrate instead on visual communication. And most importantly, the creation of themed albums, which could often not amount to several thousand images. And nothing could have prepared me for the overwhelming response that I received over in the course of the past 10 years or so. I've somehow acquired hundreds of thousands of friends, followers, and sundry strangers from every conceivable continent and country, all who seem to find some meaning and solace in the images I post. For all the flaws, frustrations, and compromises involved in the participation of social media, it does seem to provide a perfect launchpad to create something akin to an infinite archive, a panoramic work, dynamic and interactive, encompassing the whole of creation and containing multiple pathways that a reader can enter at any point and reread many times. So social media, with my Facebook and Instagram pages, I've attempted, I suppose, something akin to a live feed from the unconscious, a stream of consciousness consisting of images rather than words, concentrating on correspondences, patterns, and juxtapositions, dismantling and reassembling the constituent parts of the world, drawing on every conceivable culture, every conceivable era. And to me, this seems like a riposte to the fragmentation and atomization of the world, the world in which we live. Excuse me. Now, in recent years, this has found a way of monetizing this, which is used an incredibly vulgar term. It's the obvious next step was to go into publishing or to publish books. My latest book, Cosmic Dance, is probably the culmination of this decade-long quest to create a visual guide to the universe, and it's the most ambitious yet. So I'm going to, in the last 6 or 7 minutes, I'm going to take you on a whistle-stop tour and a very breathless trolley dash through the universe, from the beginnings of creation, through the microcosmic world, and to the infinitesimal smallness of the microscopic world, and to the vastness of outer space. So we begin. The first few images are images of creation. So the first two or three include from the Nuremberg Bible, which is possibly the first real encyclopedia published in Europe, and this represents the first day of creation. In the first three images, you'll see the idea of God as architect, God as the creator. I love this image from a Flemish Bible, which is sort of God outside of the universe, creating a bubble-style universe. And then another image from a French emblem book, again, God measuring thing. But contrast that with some other traditions where you have, these are tantric paintings from India from the mid-20th century, which represent, this is as in contrast to the European idea of God as an architect, as a controlling deity. This represents creation as a spontaneous outburst of energy, sort of from the still point of nothing, from a bindu. So all of these are representations of the moment of creation. And you'll see that some of them are quite almost phallic and sexual in symbolism. There's a striking similarity between that. And this is an extraordinary image by Hildegard von Bingen, which bears a strong resemblance to the tantric ideas. So she's created, this is her map of the universe, which is created in the 12th century by a 12th century German nun. And you see the similarity between, she regards the universe as a cosmic egg, a bit like the tantric images. And images of wholeness, circularity. This is from an alchemical text from the 17th century, Clavis Artis. From the 20th century, this is Hilmer af Klint, who I thoroughly recommend you go to the Tate if you haven't already, to see the exhibition that with Klint and Mondrian. And this is a tree of knowledge, which you see that a 20th century female visionary in contrast to the 12th century Hildegard. This is a Japanese representation of creativity, of the moment of creation. These ensos, the circles which the masters of calligraphy create in a single brushstroke, represent the universe. The broken one on the side represents incompleteness, so universe still becoming. The other image represents the three stages of the universe, it's completed. And the other and the triangle and the rectangle represent other the other levels of the other worlds. These are to move from creation to the smallest units of existence. These are this most extraordinary using science as art, which is a common theme in the books that I create. These are the images on the right are created by an Israeli scientist in their bacterial cities, manipulating bacteria in petri dishes to create just beautiful patterns. And the other image is a presentation slide from the 19th century, where with microscopes, the Victorian scientists who basically have competitions to create the most beautiful patterns using the small units of silica to images of radiolaria from the probably basically forms of plankton from the late 19th, early 20th century. An image of the olfactory bulb from a dog's nose, which is one of the first. This is the first, which is by Camillo Goli, who was the first person to actually isolate and produce illustrations of the nervous system by using a series of dyes. And that's one of the very first images of the nervous system, and contrasting with a 1950s image of a Lichtenberg pattern, which is the patterns created by lightning strikes. Also, man as microcosm. You see an image of Mars there, and an image from Robert Flood's alchemical text. So, the human being containing the whole of infinity. So, the man and human beings that contain the universe within themselves. So, these are images of zodiac man and woman. This is another tantric image of the Loka Purusha, which is the cosmic man. So it's a human being that contains the whole of the universe. So in the center of him, there are all the layers of existence and heaven and hell right on his belly, and then all the planets and stars and the constellations around him, circling around that. There's another zodiac person, and then... I'm running out of time now, so I'm going to have to dash. Patterns within patterns sort of repeat throughout art history. So these are the geometric shapes. They are the polyhedra that were designed by Leonardo and drawn by Luca Pacioli, and in comparison to one of the greats of 20th century art, Kandinsky's Circle Within a Circle. One of the best ways of understanding the Fibonacci sequence, which is at the basis of all things, is through art. So there's a George O'Keefe shell and another shell that was photographed in the 50s. And I like the correspondence. There's a crop circle there from Silbury, and 18th century drawing of a dome of the cupola of a church. Fractals, there's a Mandelbrot set there, compared to the beautiful tessellated tiles of a mosque in Isfahan. And so it's the juxtaposition and the connections and the things that... So I try to find the interconnectedness of things and the relationship to create a whole holistic vision of the world. So there we see... sort of correspondences between William Blake and an image, a Mughal painting of Jahangir, the Mughal who was best known for creating the Taj Mahal. Cosmic images, these are Volvels, which were basically, these are extraordinary. I've actually held these. These are like calculating machines. They're like miracles of paper engineering to calculate the movements of the planets and the eclipses and things like that. And then you meet the stars. And then I just love the correspondence between the sort of the interaction between that image is of Galla Placida in Ravenna. So that is an image of the roof. And the other image is of the great Islamic Book of Wonders by Al-Khazini. And it's an image of the astrological the astrological signs. To summarise, I may have these are but a few examples of our attempts to comprehend the cosmos and our place within it, and try to find the interconnectedness of all things. What I try and do on social media and in books is to try and bring a little piece of heaven down to earth. And I hope that people who visit my pages or look at my books will perceive a glimpse of wonder and beauty and mystery that still exist in the world around us. Decades have passed since my manic obsessive image-gathering days, and I and the world have experienced enormous changes. But I'm still pretty much the same, still pretty much unemployable, still unwelcome in many of the upper echelons of high society, and still collecting images, but at least I now have a vague idea what to do with them. Thank you.